S-I-P-O-O, San Francisco, baby, baby.
Shiba, shiba. Shiba, shiba. Shiba, shiba.
Let me in.
Shiba, shiba.
I want to be closer to you.
Shiba, shiba.
Open up your soul.
Shiba, shiba.
Let me find that part of you, the part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your mind.
Oh, why don't you let me in? Let me be the first to ever touch your mind.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something. And there is a show happening at the Berkeley Art Museum and Pacific Film Archive that you won't want to miss about the Great Migration. Here to talk about it, I'd like to welcome the senior curator, Anthony Graham. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. So first of all, tell us a little bit about the Berkeley Art Museum and Pacific Film Archive. How long has it been around? All the details about it.
Yeah, so the Berkeley Art Museum and Pacific Film Archive is part of the University of California, Berkeley. It's been around in various forms throughout the university's history, but opened as a museum in 1970, and then opened again in a brand new building in 2016. So we're located in downtown Berkeley, right off the BART station, really a hinge between the campus and, you know, the wider community.
And what types of art do you normally like to show at the museum?
Yeah, I mean, we have a really expansive program, and I think we are really unique because of our sort of three pillar aspects of our institution, which is art, film, and student engagement. But in the art side, we show art from all time periods and geographies with a bit of a focus on contemporary art and art from the present, such as the exhibition that, you know, we'll talk about today.
Mm-hmm. And that exhibition is called A Movement in Every Direction, Legacies of the Great Migration. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so this is a really incredible show that features 12 contemporary artists who are all invited to make new work reflecting on the history and impact and really ongoing influence of the Great Migration, which is, you know, one of the most transformative periods of history of the United States, in which, you know, millions of Black Americans left their homes in the South, moving northward, westward, and elsewhere in the South, really reshaping all aspects of our country.
And the artists that you chose, what was the reasoning for these particular artists?
Yeah, so I should also say this show is it's a traveling exhibition.
Okay.
So it was originally organized by the Mississippi Museum of Art and the Baltimore Museum of Art, showed at both of those venues, then went to Brooklyn, L.A., and now is with us in Berkeley. So the show itself has a little bit of a migration. But it features a really diverse group of artists from different places in the United States, different generations, different stages of their careers. And so all of them, I think, really started the project from a position of like personal reflection and thinking about how their own lives were impacted by this history, and then really created works that have a really open-ended conversation starting quality to them, so that audiences can really think about all of the ways that this history has impacted the places that we live, the ways that our families have moved, the ways that we have moved, and all of these things.
So what was the time period for the Great Migration, and what were some of the economic drivers of that migration?
Yeah, so the Great Migration is a period between 1915 and 1970. And, you know, many Black Americans left the South due to racial violence and racial terror in search of safety and success. And that was a huge motivator for the Great Migration.
Mm-hmm.
And something that this exhibition, you know, addresses, but also there's a real emphasis on telling other sides of that story as well, one that recognizes how traumatic this history is,
mm-hmm.
but also holds space for the ways that this history, is one of joy and optimism as well, that as individuals and families moved across the nation in search of better lives, that they did so in ways that had joy and celebration, that they brought culture with them,
mm-hmm.
they transformed the cultures of the places they arrived in, and so there's this real spirit of the things we learn and maintain across generations that's really important to the show.
Okay. Now, when we talk about the show, is it one mm-hmm. giant show, or are there themes is it divided up thematically?
You know, it's not really, because there are these 12 projects that feel very individual by
mm-hmm.
each artist.
Okay.
And yet they have incredible connections across all of them. So the themes are really almost like these undercurrents through the entire show.
Okay.
And they're there, but they're very, very open-ended in their own ways. You know, themes of memory, of sort of speculation,
mm-hmm.
Agency, and, agency,
mm-hmm.
This really sort of like personal drive in a way, and family, you know, really persists throughout the exhibition as well.
So I was reading about one of the artists, Carrie Mae Weems, and it was about her grandfather that they thought he had been killed by a white mob, but actually survived and made his way to Chicago. And I'm guessing, like, how does she tell that story? Does she tell it through?
Yeah.
Through like what are we going to see when we hear that when we're experiencing that story?
Yeah. So for Carrie Mae Weems, that installation, which is called Leave Now,
mm-hmm.
Is a video work that's sort of staged in a almost theatrical sculptural setting,
mm-hmm.
And is a really moving, if challenging, reflection on this aspect of her family's history. Her grandfather, Frank Weems, was presumed to have died, to have been killed by a white mob.
Mm-hmm.
And they learned that he had survived when his portrait was published in a Chicago newspaper.
Wow.
Because he was suing the state of Arkansas for discrimination.
Wow.
And it's an incredible story, but also one that, in some ways is left unsolved. Despite knowing that he had survived, the family was never able to reconnect with Frank Weems.
Oh.
And aside from that one instance in the newspaper, he sort of disappears from the archives of public record.
Wow. That's crazy.
And so, you know, there's also, again, this, there's often this really intense research into this history.
Mm-hmm.
I think Carrie Mae Weems is an incredible example of someone who's blending, you know, the archive, you know, looking through these public records,
mm-hmm.
and then placing those in dialogue with really personal archives, like family photographs, and wondering, about the ways that this incident that has shaped so much of her family, you
mm-hmm.
know, how it resonates across generations. And so, you know, these two archives sort of come together to tell this family story.
That's an amazing story. And another one that I saw is that there is a double wide trailer that someone's one of the artist's uncles owned, and it was a candy store during the day and a juke joint by night. Talk a little bit about that, because I find that amusing.
Yeah, so that is an installation by Theaster Gates, who's an artist that was born and raised and, you know, very much rooted in Chicago. But for this project, he recreated his uncle's double-wide trailer.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not, you know, a replica, but a sort of reimagining.
Sure.
And, you know, in so many ways, the trailer itself seems to sort of embody, you know, movement.
Mm-hmm.
But also, like, property and, again, like, agency and the ability to have a business. And so the work is sort of composed of, like, found materials, wood and metal. And, yeah, it's lined with jars of pickles,
mm-hmm.
pickled vegetables, pickled pig's feet, which reference back to the fact that it was a pickle stand that his uncle owned.
Uh-huh.
But there's also these videos of Gates performing with his band, the Black Monks, thinking about the ways that these spaces activate in other ways, you know, such as the juke joint by night, and all of the sort of family histories that get associated with these spaces. And so while Gates isn't from the South, and he's from Chicago,
mm-hmm.
The double wide becomes this sort of anchor in his memory of spending his summers visiting family in Mississippi. And so it becomes almost this imaginary place that he's recreated from his memory.
So when you were, because you're the senior curator, and when you were looking at, I guess, stills from the show before it came to you, were there things that you learned about the Great Migration that you didn't know about before you'd actually seen the artwork?
Yeah, I think one of the things that this exhibition has really foregrounded for me is the ways that the Great Migration, you know, it's so often told as a story of people leaving the South to go to the North or to go to the West.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the most compelling elements of this project that I felt like I really learned about were the stories of people who moved within the South or stayed in the South, and the ways that the Great Migration, you know, still affected their lives and the lives of their communities, and how the South, you know, of course, remains an incredibly vibrant place that mm-hmm. people choose to live, you know, across generations. And so there are some really incredible works in the show that reflect on this. I think about Akia Brion's series of textiles, which recreate photographs of her family, specifically her great-grandmother and her great-aunts.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, really pays homage to them, the women who stayed in the South and helped finance the moves of men in their lives out of the South. So thinking about the ways that they made certain sacrifices for the betterment of their family. Or another artist in the show named Allison Janae Hamilton, whose work is a video installation that thinks about the landscape of Florida and the ways that Black life and culture are so entwined with the environment there. And so what happens is that environment continues to change. So these works that take up, you know, the idea of what happens when you stay during migration is an aspect of the show that, you know, I think is really an important part of understanding this history.
Excellent, excellent. So when does the show open, or has it already opened?
It has. It opened very recently on April 13th.
Okay.
With a really exciting sort of opening day.
Mm-hmm.
And then it will remain on view until September 22nd.
Oh, that's a good long time.
Plenty of time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So for our listening audience who maybe this is their first time hearing about the museum, where is it? How do you get there?
Yeah, we're in downtown Berkeley, mm-hmm. And it's right off the downtown Berkeley BART stop. That's how I get there.
Mm-hmm.
and we're open Wednesday through Sunday, 11 to 7. And yeah, it's a great time.
Okay. And if people want to go online to learn more about the museum, how would they go about doing that?
Yeah. So our website is bampfa.org. BAMPFA.org.
Mm-hmm.
And that has all the information about this exhibition, about other programs that we're doing. There are a few events happening over the coming months. and yeah, all of our information about tickets and times and all of that stuff.
Oh, so when they go see The Great Migration, do they need a when they enter the museum, do they get to see it, or is it a separate ticket for that particular exhibit?
It's not a separate ticket.
Oh, excellent, excellent, excellent. Well, Anthony Graham, I want to thank you so much about being on the show today, and I want to thank you for inviting this exhibit to the museum.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was such a pleasure to share this with everyone.
All right. Okay, People of Earth, this is your opportunity to go check out this amazing exhibit that's happening at the Berkeley Art Museum and Pacific Film Archive. It's an amazing place. You won't want to miss it.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California, well, to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Made for you and me. As I went walking down that ribbon of a highway, I saw above me all that endless skyway. Now I saw below me that was made for you and me. For you and me, this land is your land. Oh, we're moving on down to Mississippi.
Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. This land is your land from the Naturally CD. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. Who's about to touch your mind? Well, there's some people called 42nd Street Moon, or it's a theater actually, and they put on some amazing shows. I have a friend who loves everything they do. Here to talk about Forever Plaid, which is a show that they're doing, I'd like to welcome director and musical director Daniel Thomas. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. So first of all, tell me a little bit, or tell my listening audience a little bit about 42nd Street Moon and your involvement and the types of shows that 42nd Street Moon enjoys doing.
Sure. Well, we've been, we just finished up our 30th season.
Wow.
And we started in 1993 producing lesser-known shows by some of the great composers like the Gershwins and Cole Porter and mm-hmm. Rodgers and Hart, mm-hmm. and shows that really hadn't been seen on stage for a while, and celebrating some of the great music and stories that came out of those. And as the company grew, we started to expand that mission to celebrate shows that continue to celebrate song and story, really spoke to shows that played well in our intimate space. We have a wonderful space at the Gateway Theater, seats about 200. And so there's just some great shows that you can really get the audience directly involved in and really feel like they're making a connection with the actors. So we've been really pleased with some of the shows that we've been putting in there.
Okay. So I've never heard of Forever Plaid, so tell me more about that.
When you first hear about it on paper, it sounds a little dark. The story's about a singing quartet of young men in Pennsylvania in the early 1960s, mm-hmm. and they've been doing gigs around town, and they finally feel like they're getting their first big gig, and they're on their way to it when they are killed in a car accident.
Oh, my God. Okay.
And so that's the first 30 seconds of the show.
But, okay.
What happens then is they suddenly find themselves back on Earth to do the show that they didn't get the chance to do, and over the course of that, we learn about them and their love for music and harmony and their friendship with each other. And it turns into a story about reaching for your dreams and realizing that sometimes the journey is as important as where you ended up. And the fact that they had this bond with each other, their bond for music, and how that helped them feel complete as people and as friends, really becomes an allegory for you know, how we live our lives in general. We get so focused on how successful we are or how much money we have or how much things we have that mm-hmm. we forget mm-hmm. about what the journey is along the way, because we're all going to end up in the same place. So love the things that you're doing while you're doing them. So it is a very sweet and touching show, in addition to being extremely funny.
Okay, so when was this written? Who wrote it? Like, how old is this show?
Well, the show itself was written in 1989. It was the brainchild of Stuart Ross, and it played off-Broadway for quite a long time. Very, very successful then, and before going on to become a regional show that's been well-loved. It played in San Diego for 6 or 7 years straight, I believe. Mm-hmm. But the songs are all these classic pop standards from the 40s and 50s and early 60s. And a lot of them are songs that people will have heard of, like Heart and Soul or 16 Tons, Love is a Many Splendored Thing. And there's a lot of other great music from that period that even if you don't know the titles, you'll mm-hmm. hear the tunes and you'll recognize them and you'll be humming along. And what's wonderful about it is they have these great arrangements, all of this four-part harmony, this great singing that was so evocative of that time period. So it's kind of has this modern sensibility with the scripts a little bit, but the music is this great music from the middle of the century. So it's a nice amalgamation of those.
And how did it end up on your radar?
I first got involved with the show in the year 2000. I did a production of it in Los Angeles, which was directed by Jason Graw, who was one of the original Plaids in New York.
Oh, okay.
And 42nd Street Moon audiences will know Jason. He's done several shows for us. He's well-loved by our audiences. And so I learned everything Plaid from him mm-hmm. originally. And then I ended up, this will be my 13th time working on the show. A lot of times as an actor, several times as a director and a musical director and a pianist. So it's the show that I've been involved with more than any other show in my career, and I'm really grateful with that. And I've actually ended up working with all of the other original Plaids as well. So I feel like I have a strong connection to the piece and the people who are involved in creating it. So it's been a wonderful experience for me.
I love that there's this it's like a club called the Plaids. Like once you've done the show, you're a Plaid. I love that.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Now, had you seen the show before you actually did the show?
Yes, I had seen it previously in San Diego.
Okay.
So I was familiar with it. I grew up loving harmony singing.
Mm-hmm.
I sang in my jazz choir in high school, and that kind of period tight harmony was always very special to me. And so I had a natural affinity for that music anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And then the personality types that these characters inhabit, they're somewhat socially awkward and everything, like it really played to a type for me.
Mm-hmm.
As a performer as well. So I just connected with the show from the first time that I saw it. It was just so much kind of a part of my being in a lot of ways.
Now, I think you said this, but my brain didn't register it. So is it like a barbershop where it's a cappella, or is there music behind it?
It's very much... It's sort of in between. It's not barbershop messes, but there's a very vocal jazz style that was mm-hmm. very prominent in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And groups like the Four Aces or the Pied Pipers, who sang with Frank Sinatra for a long time, and mm-hmm. even the Andrews Sisters kind of singing this tight jazz, close harmony style. And you see that coming through groups following that, like the Manhattan Transfer very mm-hmm. much carried on that tradition. And you have a lot of a cappella groups now, like Voctive or so many other groups that still sing in that jazz style. And if you go back and you listen to soundtracks from that era, you'll hear that style of music all over the place.
Now, as the director and musical director, did you have to fight the urge to sing along with the actors?
Yes, and it's funny with the choreo. I told them during the final rehearsals, and I'm sitting in the house and I'm taking notes, there were certain beats in the music where my body would involuntarily start to do the movement that they had on that
uh-huh.
beat. I couldn't help it. It was amusing.
So who are your Plaids this time, and how many Plaids are there?
There are four,
okay.
and it's a great group. All of them have been on the Moon stage before. So Edu Gonzalez Maldonado is playing Jinx, the top tenor in the group. Kevin Singer is Frankie. He's the second tenor, kind of the lead singer of the group. Justin Lopez is playing Sparky, who's the baritone. And Matt Skinner is playing Smudge, the bass. And as I said, they've all been involved in Moon projects before, and it's great to have them back. And what was really nice was that, several of them knew each other from other projects,
mm-hmm.
but they all became fast friends during the rehearsal process, which is great. When they're friends off stage, you see that on stage as well. And so that was a really nice thing to see.
Now, as a director, when you're watching your actors work with the material, I'm sure some part of the show emerges as one piece that the actors really, really enjoy doing. What's that piece in this show?
There is one moment in the show, and it is basically a tribute to the Ed Sullivan Show. And for the audience members who may not remember, Ed Sullivan mm-hmm. was basically the king of late night variety television for 25 years or so, before there was Johnny Carson or any of the ones that are on now. He kind of set the format up, and he had all of these great variety acts, great bands. The Beatles appearing on the Ed Sullivan Show mm-hmm. was their big break in America.
Mm-hmm.
That's talked about in the show. So they do kind of a tribute to that near the end of the show, and it has so many of these bits and pieces of jugglers and puppets and dancers and all these things all happening in this 3-minute song, and it's just craziness. And they're running off stage, grabbing prop, running back on, doing their bit, running back off, and they're exhausted at the end of the 3 minutes. But it is so much fun, and you can tell the fun that they're having just getting through the number. It's a lot of fun, and they were afraid of it when I explained it to them, but then once they started getting into it, they have so much fun doing it.
Excellent, excellent. So when does the show begin, or has it already happened?
We opened last weekend. We had great houses. Yesterday, Sunday, was a full house and extremely responsive audience. Everybody has been really pleased with the show, and we are running for two more weekends through May 5th. We've got performances Wednesdays through Sundays, including matinees on Saturdays and Sundays.
Okay, okay. And then how do people find out, like, where, what time? How do they find that out?
Absolutely. We you go to our website, which is 42ndstreetmoon.org, 42ndstmoon.org, and get all the information there. We have Wednesday and Thursdays at 7, Fridays at 8, Saturdays at 1 and 6, and Sundays at 3.
And then after this show goes, what's next on the agenda? Or are you taking a break?
So no, we have one more show left in our current season, and it's a beautiful piece. It's Bright Star, which was written by Steve Martin and Edie Brickell.
Oh.
And played on Broadway about 8 or 10 years ago. And it's based on an American folk tale, and it's a story of love and redemption and found family. And because it's Steve Martin, it's got this great bluegrass and folk inspired music. And we're just about to start rehearsals for that in a couple of weeks, and it's going to be a lot of fun because a lot of the actors will be playing instruments on stage along with our band. So we're looking forward to that, and we'll be announcing our 24-25 season coming up in the next few weeks.
Excellent, excellent. Well, so one more time for our listening audience, when and where for Forever Plaid, the musical.
So we are running now Wednesdays through Sundays through May 5th at the Gateway Theater in the Financial District. And you can find tickets and other information at 42ndstreetmoon.org.
All right. Well, Daniel Thomas, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right. People of Earth, if you like harmonies, this is probably the show for you. Forever Plaid. So speaking of harmonies, you know how I feel about the Jitterbug Waltz.
Gone, but here we are still dancing.
Nothing to do but waltz.
Our feet can barely move, my legs are yelling, whoa, but we're in such a groove that love is still advancing.
Nothing to do but waltz.
Can't suggest that we could go on jitterbugging. We've nothing left for moves more strenuous than hugging. But we don't need much room to gently cut a rug in we two. But waltz.
The minutes slip away, my arms just won't let go. I think I'd like to stay to where the only couple.
Nothing to do but waltz.
You never know how far this sort of thing can get.
Ooh, one never knows, one never.
Half the night with me if I would let you.
sky will melt away with joy.
I think tonight I may have found myself a
such a lucky girl to find herself a lucky boy.
And if the evening cast itself a magic spell over me,
well, all that is true is that right here with you is where I wanna be.
Just a dollar.
Here is where I stay.
I plan to keep you here all night unless you holler.
The very first hit out of Motown, it's Barrett Strong and Money, That's What I Want. Before that, we heard from the cast, Ain't Misbehavin' and Jitterbug Waltz. You have no idea how many times I have sung the refrain of Money, That's What I Want, It's What I Need. The things that you love, the people that you love, the shows that you love, they all need money to survive. Fortunately, people are willing to give money to help them survive. And here to talk about a fundraiser to help them survive from the San Francisco Mime Troupe, I'd like to welcome the producer, Taylor Gonzalez. Hello.
Hi there. How's it going?
Going great. How about you?
Pretty good, yeah. Been busy organizing this big concert festival fundraiser, but it's been good, yeah.
So before we get into the fundraiser portion of it, talk a little bit about the San Francisco Mime Troupe, how they got started, how long they've been around.
Sure. We're a theater company based in San Francisco. The company started in 1959. So this is year 65 of the company now. But it basically started out as a group of artists who were passionate about activism and workers' rights, and also kind of interested in different theatrical styles. And so back in the 60s, they started taking their shows out to public parks, and were performing for free and weren't getting permits or anything. So it was more kind of guerrilla style. They would show up, do their pieces, and every once in a while the cops would come shut them down and arrest them. And so things just kept evolving over the years. And then somewhere around the mid-80s or so, the company transitioned into being a collectively owned theater company. So we don't have like a singular artistic director. There's always been a group of people that have run it together, which is what we still do now today. There's about 10 of us that do it all together. But yeah, over the years, the message pretty much always stayed the same, making sure that we were trying to be a voice of the working class, making sure we were talking heavily about politics and, you know, bringing forth the conversations that people didn't always want to have in art.
Now,
We always do that with an original production every single year as well.
Now, I saw that you have been with them since you were 16?
Yeah. So I started with the company with the Youth Theater Project. So it's our after-school high school program that the company's been doing for 29 years now. And so I learned about it just through my high school when I was a kid, and went out to San Francisco one day for a workshop and just never left, basically.
Wow. Do you remember the show that you saw?
So the first show that I probably saw was when I was like a little baby, which I don't really remember, but my parents used to take me to shows when I was a kid. And then the first show that I really was into, I think, was probably Red State, which was somewhere in like the 2010s or something like that. But with the after school program, we were creating our own shows and writing our own scripts and everything like that. And so it was kind of a whole separate thing within the company, which we still do now. And we have our high school students that we bring in. They write their own scripts, create their own characters, and, you know, put it up. And, you know, we help put them into cool costumes, get some lighting design, sound design, and that's where I work with them now mostly, with the teaching aspect is kind of teaching them a little bit about lighting design, sound design, and then I work on all of that and implement it into their shows.
I know so many adults who got their start as, you know, they were in high school and they took part in some sort of theater thing where they got that kind of training. And one of the things I know about teens is they get really gung-ho, really passionate about the things that you do. Is that something you've observed when you're working with teens?
For sure. I mean, there's always like a little bit of a hesitancy at first of just like, who are these people? Why are we doing all these weird things? But, you know, once we get towards the end of it, especially with the groups that we have, because we have somewhat smaller groups, normally about 10 to 15 students, they kind of create their own little family at the end. And it's kind of always been that way. And so it just, there's a passion for kind of life and for, you know, speaking out and speaking their truth and stuff like that, and having a place for them to really be able to express what they want to talk about is one thing that's super important for us. And that's across the board for our company, is making sure people can get their voices heard.
Has the voice, or I guess the question I really want to ask is, has the pandemic affected what the kids want to say these days?
I think so. I mean, it's affected everybody in different ways, but it's definitely changed topics on what youth want to talk about, for sure. There was a lot of stuff that was always kind of based around like family problems or what was going on in people's neighborhoods and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But now a lot of topics that our youth are talking about are kind of internal struggles or struggles that are being put upon them, not necessarily from their family structure, but from outside forces, mm-hmm. and how they're kind of grappling with that, or grappling with their own identities and stuff. Mm-hmm. And people just wanting to discover who they are, who they want to be. So those conversations have been coming forward a bit more, for sure.
Okay. Now, one of the things that we know about the Mime Troupe is that you can go and see the shows for free. And because you're able to see the shows for free, that means that like it's a labor of love for a lot of people, but still, you know, sets need to be created. Costumes need to be created. The program that you're doing with the kids, that needs to be funded somehow. And I'm guessing that's why you're having a fundraiser.
That's part of it. Yeah. Yeah, we definitely love to provide all of our content for free.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not free to do our shows. Obviously, we're paying salaries. You know, we're maintaining our building that we own in the Mission District. And there's all kinds of fees that come with just, you know, maintaining a company and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like we're not like in a huge struggle right now, but there's definitely aspects of things that we need help with, which part of this fundraiser is going towards helping maintain the building that we have, where we're going to be hosting the event on Treat Avenue, on Treat Street in the Mission District. And so it's little things here and there. Fixing some of our storage.
Mm-hmm.
We've got some, you know, leaky windows,
mm-hmm.
some bad carpets, needing to replace some floors, some plumbing. It's an older building now, so it's, you know, all these little things that kind of just add up over time.
Sure.
And so, because, like, a lot of our financial money, or just our money right now, is mostly kind of just powering and making sure we're getting our shows going and stuff like that. So it's hard to maintain everything all at the same time.
Yeah. You have to sort of, you know, move around priorities a lot. And so, you know, the building mm-hmm. is probably like the last thing. And you're like, but if we could just, you know, just make it so that the windows don't rattle or, you know. I get that. So when is the fundraiser? And what's going to be happening at the fundraiser? You say it's a festival.
Yeah, so it's going to be happening April 27th, next Saturday, or this upcoming Saturday.
Okay.
And we'll be starting up at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and we'll be ending around 10 o'clock at night. So it's going to be an all-day adventure, basically.
Okay.
And most of it is music-based, and so that's why I've been calling it kind of a concert festival. And I've been marketing it based off of an old poster that actually Bill Graham created back in the day, back in, I guess, what was that, 1965 now. And so the styling of the poster is similar to an old Bill Graham poster who used to do fundraisers and used to help run the Mime Troupe back in the early days.
I didn't know that.
But yeah, I have about 16 different acts throughout the day. Most of it is going to be music. We've got a dance company, Destiny Arts Center from Oakland, and we have a circus company, Bow and Arrow Circus. So they'll be doing some different stuff. But music-wise, we've got a couple of rappers coming in, people who are going to be doing some funk, some jazz.
Mm-hmm.
We've got Bats Improv coming through as well, so they'll kind of do some improv music-type stuff. But it's mostly just going to be a day filled with kind of just music and just happiness.
Excellent. And can people get food nearby, or are you having food there? How does it work? So
yeah.
This is an all-day thing.
We are partnering with Beyond the Border Latin American Grill, and they're going to be bringing a food truck there. That'll be there from about 2 o'clock until about 7 throughout the day. So they won't be there the entire day,
sure.
But they'll be there for most of the day.
Got it.
And they're going to be providing some really amazing Latin Mexican food. We're super happy to be partnering with them. They're a San Francisco based catering company, I think down in South San Francisco. But it's looking like it's going to be some delicious meals for sure.
Cool. And then, so the San Francisco Mime Troupe Studio, where is that located for people who are interested in going?
Yeah, so we're located right in the middle of the Mission District at 855 Treat Avenue in San Francisco. If you are coming from BART, it's maybe a 10 to 15 minute walk away from 24th Street and Mission.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit more from 16th and Mission, but it's really easy to get to. Yeah, 855 Treat Avenue in San Francisco.
What's the cross street?
Our building is pretty easily noticeable. There's a big sign on the front that says our name. And a beautiful mural as well that was restored, I guess, what, 2 or 3 years now ago by Juana Alicia, the original artist who did it back in the 80s.
Okay. And is there a lower age range, or can you bring babes in arms?
Yeah, I would say it's a full age range. Obviously, it'll be a concert type of environment, so ear protection is probably a good thing to have.
Okay.
But I actually just talked to a friend yesterday who's going to be bringing out a face painter. Ooh. So we'll have some little games and stuff like that with them. But yeah, we'll have refreshments there with some snacks. I've got a team of bakers who are making some little baked goods as well, so there'll be some treats. But yeah, it'll be outdoors in kind of our grassy area, as well as indoors within our building. So there's definitely space to bring folks around, yeah.
Very cool. And can people get tickets in advance, or do they just buy them at the door?
They're going to just buy them at the door.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's those.
And everything is donations and stuff like that. So it's, you know, whatever you want to bring, that's up to you. And then we'll also be doing an art auction as well. So people can bid on some different items that we'll have there. You know, kind of just help with the fundraiser.
Okay. And the fundraiser, once again, is Saturday, April 27th from 2 to 10 p.m. And for people who were like you, who wanted to get involved, how would they get involved with the San Francisco Mime Troupe?
Yeah, you can find out more information from us on our website, sfmt.org, or you can contact us on Instagram at sftroopers.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of information on there can kind of, you can learn a little bit about us, and then you can also email us at info@sfmt.org. And that's kind of like our general contact thing. So it's like if you're looking to volunteer or just want to get involved in the company, you can just reach out and email us. All that information is on our website and stuff like that.
All right. Well, Taylor Gonzalez, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. I love the fact that you went in at 16 and never came out again. I love stories like that. It's like when people decide to join the circus. I just love those.
Very much so, yes.
Finding your mission at a young age. So I really appreciate it. So Taylor Gonzalez, once again, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me, yeah.
All right, people of Earth. There's so much going on in the city. If you're not going to see stuff, it's because you choose not to. It's not because there isn't stuff there. We went through a huge pandemic where nobody could do anything, and you were all miserable. Now there's tons of stuff to do. Go do it. Go enjoy. Take a bite out of life. It's time for me to turn the mic over to Mr. Ford. It'll be pleasuring your ear hole. I'm going to leave you with some Ray Charles from his album Alive at Olympia. This is part of what I did while I was gone. I was getting my kicks on Route 66. So until next week, my friends, ta-ta and toodly-doo.
Motor West, travel my way, take the highway, that's the best. Get your kicks on Route 66.